The Fan on Demand.
Sunday morning it is, Sportsnet 590, The Fan, about 3 minutes after 8 o'clock. Great day. It's going to be a fabulous day in Toronto. A little bit of a warning. The Toronto Marathon. I'll be fine. That's what happens with a large coffee in the morning. Streets are going to be hectic in downtown Toronto this time of the morning. David Grossman, my name, in the captain's chair for the next 2 hours. So settle down. We got a great program lined up for you. If you're in church, make sure the volume in the earpiece is a little low. And we got some wonderful guests from a variety of sports, and I'm sure they're going to inform us, educate us, maybe even entertain us. And here's something I could never seem to figure out, whether it's boys or men's, you name it, gymnastics or trampoline. Not available in many of our schools, 90% of them in this province, most likely because very few teachers have the qualifications to coach this sport, which is very technical, and the schools likely don't have the equipment. So the option, you got to learn at clubs. We're going to start things off with a gymnast with huge expertise, and I'm talking about the trampoline here. He won a silver medal at the Beijing Olympics, and a five-time Canadian national champ, Jason Burnett, is joining us right now. Jason, congratulations.
Hi, thanks very much.
A tremendous amount of success. I'm just trying to picture you up and down on the trampoline. Five Canadian titles. Was there one that was more special to you than another?
I think the very first Canadian title that I won was probably the most important to me anyway. That was just really the year that I finally sort of took over against all my other Canadian rivals, and then I won four more championships in a row after that. So that was really my breakthrough year.
So you're off to England, and you can sail out of the Queen for me, albeit I prefer the Duchess. The Olympic Games this summer for you. You've been this route before. Is the excitement still there, or has it kind of worn down, giving you opportunity to focus on a medal?
No, the excitement hasn't worn off, not at all. I can't wait to go back, and I can't wait to, you know, attempt to repeat my performance of the Olympic Games. It's going to be a very exciting and fun time.
I understand that you still have some kind of a world record. Can you explain that?
Yes, I can. The world record I hold is for the hardest degree of difficulty of a routine completed in training or in competition. So really what that means is every skill that we do on the trampoline has a point value based on how many twists and how many rotations we do before we put our feet back on the trampoline. And there's 10 skills per routine, and we add up each point value of all these 10 skills, and that determines the degree of difficulty. So by holding the world record for the hardest degree of difficulty, I've taken the 10 hardest skills out of anybody in the world and put them all back to back.
Wow. Jason Burnett joining us on Sportsnet 590, The Fan, an outstanding gymnast, but trampoline is his specialty. You're now 25, I think, right?
Yes, that's right.
Is that a good age for international competition in the sport?
Yeah, that's a very good age. A lot of people peak right around early to mid-20s, so I'm still pretty competitive.
You went to school in King City. From what I understand, a little bit of a shy kid. Now yeah. You're at the University of Toronto. Does it surprise you that gymnastics is not taught in our schools?
It doesn't really surprise me. I think, like you said earlier, it's very, very technical, and there you do need very proper qualifications to teach the sport. So I think just the danger level, I guess you could say, of teaching gymnastics is more than public schools want to take on.
Now, you're working hard for these Olympics. Do you have a certain standard that you have tucked away in the back of your mind? Something that you want to accomplish?
Yeah, I absolutely do. Like you said before, DD is very, very important to me. That's sort of a point of pride. So my plan is to be competing in the hardest routine at the Olympic Games, and then I just need to combine that with an element of form and an element of height, and that will give me a total score that will hopefully bring a medal home for Canada.
I would imagine precision timing or maybe some luck, combination of both of them, is what you're going to need to do well at the Olympics.
Yeah, it really, really is, just because trampoline can be a little unpredictable because the bed is such an unstable surface. You can't always control it 100%. So I would say that luck is a little bit a part of the process anyway. But also the the very, very technical part of learning to use the bed and to control the bed and push off the bed at the appropriate time comes into play, of course.
One more question before we let you go, Jason. I understand you're doing some stunt work or commercial work. Is that right?
I have done stunt and commercial work in the past. I was in a Sunny D commercial, and I was a stunt double in Scott Pilgrim versus the World for Michael Cera. But I've taken the last year or two off of that to recover from a few injuries I had and also focus on the Olympic Games coming up.
Good luck to you. We'll be cheering for you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks for joining us. Jason Burnett, Toronto gymnast, going for medals at the Summer Olympics. Let's hope he's successful, and we have a lot to cheer about. Well, up next is a woman who chose to give up speed skating and focus on rowing. And on the water, she finished first at the Canadian Under 23 Championships, chosen University Athlete of the Year in rowing. She's also this year's Female Athlete of the Year at Laurentian University in Sudbury. I'm talking about Carling Zeman, who's joining us right now. Carling, how you doing?
Hi, good.
Rowing interest started for you at Laurentian University in Sudbury. I understand this is like fresh for you, making the transformation from one sport to another. Tell us how you were able to go from becoming a beginner to a Canadian champion in what, 2 years?
Yeah, it wasn't easy. I think that when I've been doing sports my entire life, so I think growing up doing that, it just becomes a part of you. Like, it's bred into you every day, and every competition that you have, it's just another step towards winning those medals. You know, I don't think it really matters what sport it is. Mm-hmm. The training ideas and philosophy is all the same in each sport. Like, you just have to work hard, and if you're working hard enough, then you're going to get somewhere.
You were a late cut for Canada's Olympic team going to England. Does that just, in your case, boost the adrenaline for the Rio de Janeiro Games in 2016?
Oh, definitely, definitely.
Now, Rowing Canada, they released the names of the team going to the World Cup later this month in Switzerland. And were you expecting to be on it?
I'm actually trying out for the under-23 team. So I am definitely hoping to be on that team, yes.
You're 6'2", the single sculls. I guess that's the event where you row with two oars rather than just with one. Considered one of the most demanding disciplines on a sport that some people describe as being a punishing sport. It works the body's major muscle groups. Why did you choose that event rather than being in a four or an eight shell?
I go to Laurentian University. There's not, mostly I'm just put in the single because I'm alone. I don't have anyone to train with, so it's partly a personal choice, but partly just situation. Also, I came from a lot of independent sports, so I'm pretty used to, you know, competing on my own and learning how to deal with that kind of pressure without, you know, another or three other or seven other teammates behind me.
You also come from a family of athletes as well, so I would imagine that is all encompassed in how you deal with a sport and a challenge. And what kind of time do you devote to training and competition?
Oh, wow. I would say that since I started rowing intensely a lot, like, you need to be prepared to give up a lot of your social life, a lot of your school life. It's a big commitment. You can't really come into it half focused and only half wanting it. I mean, that's never going to get you through the entire off season training year and even the on season training year. You need to be fully focused and wanting it 100%. So.
Outstanding rower Carling Zeman joining us, the Female Athlete of the Year at Laurentian University in Sudbury. A couple of weeks ago, a month ago, you were chosen. And now you were also selected the Sculler of the Year earlier this year. How do you deal with all these accolades and knowing that you you excel and you adapt to sports so well?
You just have to kind of take them as they come. It's definitely some of these awards, you know, came as a bit of a surprise to me because I am so new to this sport. Like, only last year I was looking up at these people and being like, wow, I mean, they've been rowing for almost 10 years and I, you know, it'd be great to be up there, but I don't think, like, I'm still quite a ways off. So now when I got some of these awards this year, it was pretty rewarding. I mean, I put in the time, I put in the effort and training, and it definitely paid off for me.
You look at some of the success that Canada has had on the female side of rowing, Laumann and McBean, and would you see a role model for yourself, somebody that you sort of want to take after, or is this strictly a Carling Zeman approach?
To be honest, I don't. I'm still pretty patriotic to speed skating. Most of my athletic heroes are all speed skaters and winter sport people. So I don't really discriminate against the different sports, just specific athletes.
Is it true that high performance athletes are considered to be muscular and lanky, which helps with things such as leverage and power and technique?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it doesn't, you can have a shorter person in the boat and they'll get there because of their hard work, but I think it makes it a little bit easier if they have the height and they have the physical ability, their athleticism. And I mean, I'm 6'2" and I grew up on a farm, so I'm not exactly small.
What's the next big event for you coming up?
That would be the U23 World Championship.
And where are they taking place?
They're in Lithuania.
Well, good luck. Let's hope everything goes your way. And as you progress in this sport, maybe multi-sport athlete, who knows down the line, success not only in school, but also success on the water as well. We appreciate you joining us, Carling. Thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you.
One of Canada's emerging female rowers, and also the female athlete of the year at Laurentian University in Sudbury. I'm talking about Carling Zeman, who was just with us. We got to row your boat, in our case, out right now. A sports update is coming up. And when we come back, our next guest just might have what you would call a black belt. She'll speak about it in the sport of judo and her success coming up. It's Sunday morning with David Grossman on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Sportsnet 590, The Fan. David Grossman is my name. And a very good morning to you. It's going to be another beautiful day in the city. So get up, go on out, enjoy the weather. I got to tell you, I got a black belt. And I also have a brown belt, too. And the reason for that is to make sure the pants don't drop. But our next guest, well, she practices judo for fun, but also for major competition. And she's a student at York University. She's off to Miami in a couple of days for a major competition. A former Canadian female athlete of the year in the sport at the age of 20. And she's focusing on making Canada's Olympic Games, not the ones this summer, but the ones in Rio de Janeiro. And if things continue to progress the way they are for her now, there's a pretty good chance she's going to be there. I'm talking about Nicole Jenisek, and she's joining us now. Appreciate her time. Nicole, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for making time for us. Can you maybe spend a little bit of time and make me a little bit better athlete than I think I am, which is not much at all, in the sport of judo? I mean, what does it take to get somebody new to get involved in a sport like judo?
Well, you can search up your local clubs. There's one in pretty much every city. You can start as young as 6, and it's just dedication, training 2 to 3 times a week when you're younger. And as you get older, you progress and you can train more and then incorporate side training, so cardio and things like that, so you're better off in tournaments.
Now, do you use this sport for fun and competition, or is there a little bit of self-defense as well?
There is self-defense. I'm very confident that if someone were to come at me, that I would be able to defend myself.
I would imagine. You'd probably break their neck, too. A big event coming up for you in Miami in a couple of days. Is that the U.S. Open?
Yes, it is.
Is this a first time for you?
Nope, this would be my second time.
And how'd you do last time?
Last time I came 7th out of 14, I believe.
Not bad.
Yeah, very tough.
You think you can do better?
Yes, of course. I'm going for gold this time.
Has judo taken over your life, you know, in the same way that I guess hockey and baseball tends to do, maybe even basketball, some other sports and soccer, to players your age that you just, you know, can't stop? You got to practice, you got to play, you got to be involved 7 days a week. Is that the same situation for you in judo?
Yeah, it's exactly the same thing. All I want to do is eat, sleep, and do judo.
You rank number one under 20 years of age in Canada.
Yes.
Number two in the senior category for the 57 kilos. Are you allowed to compete against, I guess you are, people who are older than you?
Yes.
And how do you fare?
I do actually pretty well. Just because they're older than me means they have a little more experience, but technically I may be on par with them or a little better than them or maybe a little less better than them.
From what I understand, you have been in something like 150 tournaments. You've placed among the top finishers in 95% of them. Do you consider this just being the better athlete, a little bit of luck, or is this hard work now showing off?
This is hard work, dedication, and a lot of time, and a wanting to. You always have to want it.
Nicole Genesik joining us on Sunday morning on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Judo is her specialty. This year has been good to you so far. Silver medal at the Senior Commonwealth Games in Wales. You're a carded athlete. What's the next challenge after the U.S. Open?
My next challenge coming up is a tournament in Slovenia and Prague, and then after that is Canadian Senior Nationals.
So you had a busy year coming your way.
Yes, quite busy.
In addition to competing, I understand you're also a fully certified instructor. Do you teach or do you coach as well?
On Mondays and Tuesdays before practice, we have a younger kids class, and yes, I do help.
What's it like with, I would imagine you teach girls and guys. Do the guys sort of feel a little intimidated learning from a woman?
No, they like to come at me and try and throw me. They think it's fun.
And what happens?
Sometimes they throw me. They're pretty good.
All right. Your status on the senior national team, can you talk to us a little bit about it?
Right now I am ranked 2nd. I hopefully going to change that coming in July.
We're talking about the senior national team.
The senior national team.
And you're how old?
I'm 20.
Wow. That says something right there about the quality and the caliber of this sport and what you know about it. Recent competition in Montreal, I don't think you did as well as you had expected.
No.
How hard is it for an athlete and a good athlete, somebody like yourself, to come back from, I guess you could call it a mental letdown?
It's a little tough. I was disappointed the day of. But it always makes me feel better when I can come home and go to my coach and plan a strategy for next time and then be more prepared. And now it's just the waiting to redeem myself, to prove myself again, to work on what I've been learning for the past few weeks.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate your time. Congratulations on a tremendous amount of success in a short period of time. And we're hoping for more good news when you go to Miami in a couple of days. Nicole Genesik, guys, stay away from her. You just heard. She could flip you left, up, down, center. You don't want to mess with her. Trust me on that one. We're going to change sports and switch over to football. And what a year it's been for Doug Corby. His high school team wins the Halton title, then a bowl game. Then he commits to Queen's University for the fall. Very good school, academically as well as for football. Chosen to the tryout list for Team Canada. And the June 28th International World Championship taking place in Austin, Texas. And then he also gets to meet with me. So it's been a great year so far for him. Football is big in his life. And we have Mr. Corby Jr., I should say, joining us right now. How are you doing, Doug?
Thanks. How are you?
Very well, thank you. So meeting me must have been the highlight so far. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, exactly.
There you go. You don't want to go anywhere near our previous guest. Trust me. Yeah, black belt. She'll flip you up and down. It's like getting tackled 20 times in a football game.
Oh, no doubt.
As an athlete and your success in football, what when you look at it, what's been the biggest thrill for you in the past year?
Probably the biggest thrill for me was down at the Sky Dome when the Golden Horseshoe Bowl championship game. That was just a huge thrill playing at the CFL, you know.
You know, it's the Rogers Center.
Yeah, Rogers Center now, eh?
Yep. You guys from Burlington, you got to remember that, right, when you come to the big city. You're also a former athlete of the year and a football MVP at Nelson High School. That's in the city that's squished somewhere between Toronto and Hamilton. How do you deal with, winning and success? And, you're still a young guy like this. You're moving from being one of the top athletes at your high school to one of the youngest athletes at a university level. How do you deal with all that kind of stuff, the emotional change, the adjustment?
Well, the biggest thing for me is that my parents taught me, my grandpa, is just to stay humble. You know, with all the accolades, you still got to stay humble, you know, down to earth. You don't want to get too, crazy with that. And then going into next year, I just want to be prepared and just, I'm just another rookie out there, trying out for the team.
Doug Corby, how do you stay humble when there's got to be a little bit of ego in there as an athlete?
You gotta have a little bit of an ego, a little bit of, swagger to you, but you don't want to sound too cocky, You just don't want to do it. Guys hate that. You just want down to earth and joke around with the guys.
I find it interesting that you were into basketball big time, more than any other sport, and then this year, grade 12, you switched to football. What was it that appealed to you so much that you put away the round ball and you took up the funny shaped ball as a wide receiver?
Well, our head coach, Bob Stacey, he's been bugging me to get out there, ever since I was in grade 9. And then my grade 12 year, he finally got me out there, and just everything clicked.
A little bit more physical contact in this game than in basketball, right?
Yep.
When did you get the invitation to try out for Team Canada, and what was your reaction?
I got it a couple months beforehand, and I wasn't really expecting it, I was still only 2 years into football. I didn't know I was that well known yet. And when I got it, my face lit up, and I called my parents right away, and I told them, and we were all excited.
Something like about 80 of 400 players invited to tryouts. When did you put on your mental hat, your physical hat, hopefully to convince coaches that you should be on this Canadian team that will get onto a plane for these games in Austin, Texas, that because they have to trim the rosters a bit. They've got to say goodbye to some of the athletes. They can't take everybody. What is it that you think you're going to be able to convince the guys in charge that you should be wearing the red and white of Canada?
Well, you just got to go out there and just game time all the time. You got to be in the zone. As soon as I found out, I was at the gym working hard again, training hard, trying to get back in the best player I could be.
What is it about the game? You're a wide receiver. You like grabbing the passes. I understand you're quick as well. What is it about football that you said to yourself, man, I should have got involved in this sport a lot sooner than now?
I just love your one-on-one on the outside with the corner or the half, and then, you're relying on another person to get you the ball. There's just so many fundamental pieces to football, You got the linemen, the linebackers, the quarterback, the running back. There's so many fundamental pieces, and wide receiver is one of them. I just wanted to play a big part in that and bring the team a championship.
Doug Corby, are you one of these athletes that as a kid you dreamed about playing the pro game, forming your life around a future where you'd make a couple of bucks and then you'd be able to put your feet up, settle down and relax and think about retirement? Or is football and sport just something you do to keep in shape, have some fun, but you're focused on a career and something else?
Oh, no, I was one of those little kids when I was younger, for sure. I wanted to play in the NBA. It was my dream. I got a court in my backyard, and I would be out there shooting every day,
But when does reality set in? Is this something that you learn on your own, or is this something that you learn in conversation with your parents and with others that, I got to think about what I want to do. There's a potential for injury, maybe, God forbid, down the line. What do I want to do with my life when I get, shall I say, to be as old as your parents? And that's young, right?
Yeah.
Well, do you have in mind what you want to do career-wise?
I sort of do. It's kind of like a self-discovery thing down the road. In university, maybe I'm not as good as I am, or, maybe I'm not pushing myself as good. Maybe I should start thinking about another career, what I want to do when I'm older,
What made you decide to go to Queens?
Coach Sheehan, I loved him the very first time I met him when we started recruiting me. I went down on my first recruiting ship, and I just fell in love with the place right away. It's a great place, and I'm very happy with my choice.
Now, I don't know if Coach Sheehan is into fishing or not, but he seemed to give me the impression when I spoke to him about you that you were one of the top catches And I interpret that to be fishing in the greater Toronto area. He just loves your explosive speed. He likes your attitude. It's like he's adopting another member of his family. As soon as he got you committed, you could see the smile on his face that he's got a real winner. Are you expecting to go into Queens and start in the fall?
Well, you can't really expect to go in and start. And coaching, you can't make any promises, right? There's so many variables you don't know about. But I want to go in there and be an impact player right away. And, you know, dress and get them and push for some playing time.
Something big coming your way that, you know, everybody sets their mind on a huge challenge. Is it the opportunity to play for Canada in Austin, Texas? Or is the big challenge for you to get focused and ready for that first practice at Queens?
I think right now I need to focus on the first practice at Queens, and playing for Team Canada is just an honor. So I'm still training for that, but I think the big challenge is going to be playing with guys, you know, 4 years older, a lot faster, more experienced, and playing at another level.
There are a lot of students who are listening to you right now and their parents as well. What advice would you give them in making their selection, their decision when it comes to saying goodbye to high school and moving on to post-secondary?
Just work hard, and whatever you choose, you know, make sure it's the right one. You got to have a feeling, or like the right type of feeling with the place, and as soon as you get that feeling, you'll know.
There you go. Two very important words. You've heard it from someone who's benefited from it. The words work hard. Doug Corby, thanks very much for joining us. Good luck. We appreciate your time, and I'm sure you'll be on that plane to Texas if everything goes your way. Look forward to seeing you in a Queens Gales football jersey in the fall. Again, thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
There you go. Parents, bit of note. Take note of this. Work hard. Convince your kids that rewards come from that, and staying focused as well. Doug Corby, a member of the Nelson High School football team, now committed to Queen's University for academics, but also for athletics, and hopefully soon training to represent Canada at the International Football Federation Finals next month in Austin, Texas. We're going to be back in a few minutes with a special treat. Both of them, the top university athletes in Canada. That's right, the top male and the top female, both from the same university. You're going to want to hear this. Sunday Morning with David Grossman continues on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Just take those old records home, yeah. I said listen to them by
Sunday Morning on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. David Grossman with you until 10 o'clock. You can send me an email at sundaymorning@fan590.com or tweet me at GrossmanFan590. Well, Canadian universities had a contest to determine the top male and the top female athletes of the year. This is a national award. And for one of those rare times, both those honors went to the same university. And both athletes played the same sport. Rare, as I say, but it's legit. And we have both athletes joining us right now. Marc-André Dorion and Anne-Sophie Batté are from McGill University in Montreal, and both are shall we say, on the platform, right at the top, on the spotlight, under the spotlight. Success for both of them. And as I say, they're with us right now. Congratulations to both of you, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Marc-André, I got to ask you, top university defenseman in Canada in hockey, tryouts with three National Hockey League teams, yet you made the choice to sign a pro contract to play the next couple of years in Austria. What made you go that route?
Definitely the fact that they were the first one to offer me contracts. I didn't want to end up with nothing or end up playing the East Coast or something like that. So I had a good offer from Lens in Austria, and maybe the style of play that matches the most my style of play. So I just decided to go there, see what it looks like to play professional hockey, and after that we'll see.
And Sophie, bonjour, by the way. Good morning. And some athletes, they think that based on their success as a university student, an award like this is deserving. Were you surprised when they announced your name as the top female in this country?
I really was surprised. I mean, it's such an honor for an athlete and to win such an award. And I told Marc-André, I said, there's both of us here, and I'm pretty sure one of us is going to win, and I have a feeling it's going to be you. I mean, they had one national for the first year, and so in my head, Mark was going to win, and I was not going to be a winner. But, like, already being there was a big accomplishment. And then one day when they announced my name, I was really shocked and really surprised and happy, I guess.
And Sophie, is it true that you were recruited to McGill at the age of 12?
Well, okay, I wasn't recruited at McGill, but I met Peter Smith, so the current coach of McGill, when I was 12. I moved from a small town, Sept-Îles, to Montreal, and back home, I only played with boys, but when I moved to Montreal, I had the chance to pick whether I should play with guys or girls, and I met this man, and he told me to go play with boys for a couple of years, and then after to switch to women's hockey, and then after he got in contact with me and then approached me and showed me his interest of me going to McGill. So that's kind of how it worked out.
Marc-Andre, you get a gold ring and a trophy. And what I really like also on top of that is $10,000 towards continuing your education. Can you just take the money and use it for other reasons, or do you have to use it towards tuition?
I wish I could use it for the reason. I don't think we can. It's a scholarship to keep studying in a Canadian university. So I don't know yet how long we have to use it. But as I said, I'm pursuing my professional hockey career now, so I'm putting my studies on hold, but never know, you know, in the future or even when I'll be away to do some correspondence courses with universities. So we have to look at that, but no, it's obviously a great honor and a big amount of money, so we'll try to figure something out.
You know, former McGill hockey coach Martin Raymond, now coaching with Guy Boucher in Tampa. What did a guy like Raymond mean to you, Marc-Andre?
Well, he was a mentor to a lot of our guys this year, because we were for eight of us that were graduating, that were in our fourth year, and he recruited all eight of us before leaving for in the Bulldogs during my second year. So obviously, he was a mentor. He built a McGill hockey program to success, and he's the one that made that program so successful in the past few years. So obviously now that he's in the NHL, we look up to him, and we're just really happy to have had this guy at McGill and build the program the way it is right now.
Here's something I find really interesting. Coaches are always strict about practices and pregame meetings, and you came close, Marc-Andre, to being late for one of your pregame, shall we say, sessions at McGill, and I understand you came even closer to quitting university hockey. Is that right?
Yeah, well, during my first year living on the South Shore of Montreal, I was traveling to go to games, and I left to get to the rink an hour before, and usually it only takes me 20 minutes to get there, so I had more than enough time on a usual day, but there was a snowstorm that day, and I came in at the rink at 5:02, and Marty was starting his pregame speech at 5 o'clock sharp. So I got in the rink, and my captain was in the hallway, and he was like, "No worries, no, you know, no one saw that you weren't there, so you'll be able to play and everything." So ended up getting changed, getting ready for the game like I usually do, trying to not be noticed, but 15 minutes after that, the assistant coach brought me in the coach's office, and we talked about me being late and what it meant to the team, because we had strict rules, and you know, we have to respect those rules to be successful. So after that, the coaches talked about it, and they decided to scratch me for the game. It was probably the first time I got scratched in my career. I was not really happy with that decision, but at the same time, it showed me that, you know, you got to respect the rules, and you got to make sure that you're always on time. So that was for that story, and me about quitting McGill. It was a really hard start to get to McGill. You know, adjusting to a big university, adjusting to language, adjusting to coming back in a big city. Because before that, I used to go to Bécomo in the CJEP. There was 500 people, and now coming to McGill with 20,000 people, it was a big change. So all those adjustments, and going to the Dallas rookie camp during my third week of school, it was really hard. But I'm glad I made the choice to stay, and it ended up pretty good.
And Sophie, McGill had expectations of winning the Canadian gold medal in women's hockey. It didn't work out that way. Does this award make up for it?
I mean, this is, I don't think it's comparable. One of them is, you know, you fight for throughout the year, and that's pretty much what your team expects you to win. Well, we expected our soft win. That was our goal. I mean, and for the BLG award, I don't think an athlete can say, you know what, this year I'm going to train and I want to be nominated for the BLG. So I think this is how it can differentiate. Does it make up for it? I know, because it's something great to be part of, winning a national championship and being able to celebrate that with your teammates. And winning this award, well, it was great. I mean, there was like me and Marc Andre celebrating together, but even though my team was not present with me, I know that they were all behind me and they helped me achieve what I accomplished this year.
You're French Canadian. You speak English very well. What was the challenge of studying in English, and how much English you spoke when you first got to McGill was minuscule, from what I understand. Look at how well you've excelled, not only on the ice, but off the ice as well.
Oh, thanks. I studied at Dawson College, so for 2 years. Before that, I was always in regular English, coming from a small French town, did not speak a word of English. I remember when I moved to Montreal, we moved in the West Island, in an English area. I would go to hockey practices and I would barely understand what my coach would be saying. So I would have kind of to see and look at the drawing and kind of figure it out. And my first year of CEGEP was really, really challenging. We had like 7 classes, and I honestly did not know where to focus my attention. I would try to take notes and then I would lose track of what the teacher's thought would be. And then, so I had to find a balance. I was shy to speak. And then, like, people will make fun of me, like, pronouncing words. And at the end of the day, I said to myself, if I want to be bilingual, I will need to get out of my shell and talk. And I'll benefit from this. And I think that it was just a matter of watching TV in English, talking to people, and just being around English people. And I'm really happy, because living in Quebec, it's a requirement almost to have a job. And I'm studying in business, and it's a man. I guess you have to speak both languages to function properly.
Well, you're both great individuals, both ambassadors for university sport in this country, outstanding athletes, and the bonus now being the number one athlete in this country, winners of a prestigious award. Marc-André Dorion, congratulations to you. Good luck in Austria. And Anne-Sophie Batté, again to you. Top female, both hockey players, McGill University. Success. I guess that's all you could say in both of your passions and your desire to move on. And thank you for joining us this morning. Merci beaucoup.
Thank you
very much.
Wow, let's check out the squash scene after having two great athletes like that. I mean, that's what it's all about. Success in the classroom, but success also in sport. Two very, very good ambassadors. As I say, we'll check out the squash scene because we have another great ambassador joining us right now. The Canadian Championships ended yesterday at Niagara-on-the-Lake at the White Oaks Resort. And our next guest has won medals at the Pan Am Games. She's one of the top female players on the squash tour. 21 years old, Samantha Cornett is joining us, ranked number one in the Open Women's Singles. Sam, thanks for doing this on what's been just a hectic week for you and in competition as well. Tell me, you were ranked number one against the two-time defending national champ, Miranda Ranieri, in the final. She ends up winning yesterday. What happened?
Well, combination of things, but she was really on fire yesterday. It was, I think she was out there ready to defend her title because she won it for the last 2 years, and she was on fire.
But you had things were going your way. You beat Maya Kirk, then you eliminated Holly McNaughton, number 8 ranked. Then there was that tough match with Suzanne King, and it just seemed as if you were on a roll as well. I guess that's what happens when you have two elite athletes clash in a championship.
Yeah, I think you're right, absolutely. And if you look at my side of the draw and her side, she had a similar progression through to the finals. So, we were both in tough, and she showed up yesterday. So,
can one make a lot of money on an international squash tour?
When you're traveling to tournaments, you're not going to make a whole lot of money. You're probably hoping to break even with your expenses. Once you get into the top 10, it gets a bit more lucrative, I think.
Have you found the competitive level in this country in squash to be tougher each year, or is it just holding its own?
Well, it kind of changes every year, to be honest. Since I started playing 3 years ago on the Pro Tour, it's been quite a turnover. Like, there's been kind of 3 different generations that I've seen in 3 years. So There's a bunch of young players that are coming up, and I'm really looking forward to working with them and seeing what they have to offer.
You're now a pro 3 years, but let's go back to your introduction to this sport. How did that all happen?
Funny. My parents weren't competitive or anything, but they took it up in university. And I think that's funny because a bunch of my friends right now are starting to play in university too. So I can only hope that maybe one of their kids plays as well. But it was just one of many sports that I played when I was younger. And for some reason, it really stuck. I just love it so much. It's so fun.
One more question I got to ask you. What are the chances of squash again becoming an Olympic sport?
In my personal opinion, I think it's really high because it's just got so much to offer, and there's been so many new developments within the sport. And I mean, like, for example, Squash Canada is buying an inflatable court that they can travel around in Canada with. And there's so many things coming up that I think point to in the right direction, and I hope the Olympics committee takes notice.
Outstanding success for you on the squash court. You still have an opportunity to teach at squash camps. Just a tremendous, tremendous path lying ahead for you. We appreciate you joining us this morning. And don't let one setback turn you off. There's a lot more coming your way, and we congratulate you on that.
Cheers.
Samantha Cornett, the pride of Deep River, Ontario, until she made Toronto her new home, an excellent squash player, role model, and member of the National Center of Excellence. When we return, we got an interesting guest lined up. A high school principal is going to join us, not pleased that his students don't have a chance, at least some of them, to compete with others their age because of a controversial rule that continues to play havoc. Sunday morning continues. I'm David Grossman. This is Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Prizes like no other, from a club like no other, The Fan Club. Log on to sportsnet590.ca. He's our big man on campus. Sunday morning with David Grossman. Sportsnet 590. The Fan.
Sunday morning it is, 2 minutes after 9 o'clock. Sunshine in Toronto. And also a marathon causing some disruptions to downtown traffic. And I say some. David Grossman's my name. Sunday morning, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. You can read my blog at www.fan590.com. And you can also join our growing list of folks signed up to listen to past, present, and future editions of this show on podcast. It's absolutely free. You could just check our website, again, www.fan590.com. Well, with so much money being spent by government, convincing kids to get active, beat obesity, get involved in sports, decisions are actually being made to prevent some students from playing sports. Now, I don't think anybody wants to see elite athletes stacking high school teams. And I'm not saying that's the case at the school of which our next guest is representing. But just giving young people a chance to participate and with coaches who are also certified. At Ascension of Our Lord High School, Mississauga, or Malton, this is a school of about 800 students, sports teams that often compete in a Tier 2 level. Students play sports to have fun. I mean, they're not going to the pros or to the Olympics. We hope they do, but they're not. But an athletic association has chosen to prevent a few from playing for their own school. And the reason? The association claims violations by students to a rule that's been around for a long time is controversial, it's contentious, and they don't even take into account exceptional circumstances that have affected the lives of these students. The principal of Ascension, I should say, is joining us right now. Herman Vittori is one person quite concerned. Valori, I should say. I'm all right. I'm just bothered by this whole thing, as you could tell. He's one person that's very concerned about what's happening and how people are telling him how his students can or cannot play sports. Good morning, sir. How are you today?
Good morning. How are you, David?
Very well, thank you. And my apologies again. Herman, it seems like people are saying you can play and you can't play. And I think you're the CEO of your school. Do you not have a say in the matter on whether students can participate, represent your school in competition?
No, absolutely not.
There's something wrong with that.
Well, there are rules in place that govern this. You know, we belong to RAPSA, which is Regional Appeal, which governs all of the high schools for appeal and offering appeal. There are rules in place that, I guess, safeguard against unfair practices about students moving schools for athletic reasons, and I understand that. However, there are circumstances, special circumstances, that govern some of these that should provide exceptions for some students, and these are recognized through an appeal process. However, my experience in this case is that the rules are still applied to the letter of the law without consideration for the special circumstances, so that we now end up with students unable to play for really spurious reasons.
You got one student, I understand, Herman, who came to your school from another school after her house burned down. And
that's
she
correct.
Was forced to move in with another parent. She's no Olympic athlete, yet she can't play for her school. She can't participate because of this change in addresses. And the other returned to Ascension, and I say returned because she was originally an Ascension student, after her grades were somewhat of a concern, or some people would call it a disaster in the public system. She didn't play sport last year, and yet her situation also ruled ineligible. She could not play. Can you not, as a principal of a school, see to it that these students are allowed to participate?
Well, again, I cannot. I have to go through the process, and the process is that they were declared ineligible by RAPSA, so the appeal process directed that the case be brought up before OFSA, which is the provincial association that RAPSA belongs to. Our coaches, Marco Magistrale and his sister, Michelle Magistrale, made the effort to come up with preparing a case to present to this appeal panel, showing them very clearly why these students should be allowed to play. And there were three cases that were brought up before the appeal panel. Two of them were turned down. One was approved. But for the two that got turned down, for example, for the one student who attended Ascension from grade 9 and grade 10 was asked by her mother to move to the other school in Malton, to Lincoln, in order to be able to care for her siblings, which she did. Unfortunately, this year actually, when she was there for the first semester, her marks, her academic marks, really dropped. So then she decided, and after discussion with her mother, to return to Ascension and wanted to play for one of our teams. Unfortunately, she was disqualified from playing because she had played for another school last year. And guess what? That other school is Ascension. So now she can't play for Ascension because last year she played for Ascension.
What's the next step?
What do you do
now, Herman? Do you just sit back and accept the decision that's been made by an organization that, I guess, you're at the mercy of their decision with no accountability? Or is there something that you and the Board of Education can start to do to get kids more active, more involved, and rather than get penalized for some ridiculous reasons such as what you've explained?
Well, it's not that simple, because now we have an association and a bureaucracy that you have to sort of navigate through. And for these two students who have been declared ineligible, there's no other appeal process. They just will not be able to compete without official teams, and that's the end of the story for them.
It's a darn shame, and it's a shame that these kids have now been. This is high school sport, and they've been told they cannot participate. Herman, we got to move along. We thank you very much for your time. Maybe one day people will find ways to help youngsters out, such as what you're doing, and some of your staff, rather than prevent them from participating in sport. Good luck to you, and again, thanks for your time.
Thank you, David.
Herman Valoria, principal of Ascension of Our Lord High School, out to help his students. But even he has no say on who can play sports for his school because of decisions by an athletic association. Let's turn to something. When I first heard about this, I thought, how is it possible? Wheelchair rugby. Well, this summer, Garrett Hickling is going to his fifth Paralympic Games. Now, think about it. 5 Paralympic Games, this time in London, England, with Canada's wheelchair rugby team. Just a phenomenal performance. And maybe he can explain to us as we welcome him in this morning just exactly how wheelchair rugby is played. Good morning, Garrett. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks. Good. And you?
Very well, thank you. I'm just trying to imagine this. I heard words referred to this sport as murder ball. I don't know if that's a good word or not, but try to describe to us how this sport of wheelchair rugby takes place.
Well, wheelchair rugby takes place on a basketball-style court. It's tough for us to wheel on grass, of course. But basically, I classify it as try to wheel the ball across the goal line, full contact, hit the guy, try to knock him out of his chair, do what you can to stop him.
Wow. I mean, this can be really fairly physical.
Definitely, definitely. A lot of chair contact, and our chairs do get beat up and replaced every year or two.
You've been a dominant player in the sport since its emergence, and you've been all over the world representing this country. What is it that you haven't won, that you still want to win while you're able to compete?
I'm still going for the Olympic Paralympic gold medal. Do have 2 silvers and 1 bronze, but the gold medal would definitely finish the package.
Now, you're 42, is that right?
41, yeah.
41. Some would say maybe a bit up there in years. Others would probably say, no, that's just fine. As long as he is willing and can compete and can qualify and make the Canadian team, good luck to him. What is it, though, I mean, that keeps you hooked on this sport? Is it knowing that you're going to get another chance in 4 more years to go for the gold medal? Or do you just do this because you're fascinated and have this passion for the sport?
Probably more I have the passion for the sport. I did always say, as long as I'm having fun, I will continue to play. And 19, 20 years later, I'm still playing and still having fun. Just the players, the camaraderie, the people I meet around the world have just been phenomenal.
I was reading your description of your occupation, and for a 41-year-old, I found it interesting. Full-time athlete.
Yeah. Yeah, it does take a lot of time with doing training and various things 6 days a week, and that is tough to do jobs in there, especially when we do a lot of traveling, especially on Paralympic years.
Have you ever been hurt in the sport?
A few times, yes, I have.
To what extent?
In 2002, I believe, I've had to have reconstructive neck surgery. 2007, I ripped my tricep off. Have suffered a few concussions, a few broken fingers.
That hasn't stopped you from continuing to play?
No, still loving the game and still like going hard.
Garrett Hickling joining us, going to his 5th Paralympic Games this summer in London, England, representing Canada in the sport of wheelchair rugby. How do you react when people say, you know, you're an inspiration to others with disabilities? And the reason so many are involved in sport is because of what you do. How do you react to something like that?
Quite often than not, I take it on a good side. I do see that sports involvements with people, everyday people, people with disabilities, people with regular abilities, it improves their everyday life skills and styles, and I've seen that for everybody throughout the years, and to me, I like seeing that, so that's my inspiration.
I mentioned before the word murder ball, which is something they refer to, some people refer to in wheelchair rugby. Do you like that name?
I kind of do like that name. It was the original name for the wheelchair rugby back when it was developed in Canada in the late 70s. And to be, a known sport, they've adapted the name of wheelchair rugby just because murder ball is a little different to some people, I guess.
I think it's been 10 years since Canada last won a world championship. I may be wrong. You can correct me in wheelchair rugby Paralympics. What's the plan for Canada this summer?
It has been 10 years. 2002 is when the last time we won the world championships. Our plan, we got 12 strong guys ready to go play hard. We've been working hard. We've been doing lots of traveling, lots of training together this season. We are getting together again in a couple of weeks, and then we're pretty much together right through to the mid-September. So if we continue doing what we're doing and play hard, I got no problem seeing us winning gold medal there.
Garrett Hickling, you and the Canadian team have won medals in the past two games, a bronze in Beijing and a silver in Athens. Good luck in England this year. Come back with a medal, but have a lot of fun as well. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Garrett Hickling, two medals. Wow. Can you imagine that? Two medals, not just participating, but coming back with two great accomplishments. Up next, a legend in Canadian track and field. Stay with us. We'll tell you all about him. He'll join us as he's being inducted into a Hall of Fame. Sunday Morning continues with me, David Grossman, on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Sunday Morning, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, 22 minutes after 9 o'clock. Wow, lots of email. A lot of angry listeners, parents, and others, they're not happy that school athletic associations have so much power and can prevent teenagers, especially those with special circumstances, from playing sports for their high school. Boy, some real, shall I say, bitter comments. Some of them I can't even repeat. That's a shame. It really is a shame when a high school student has been banned by teachers, athletic associations. Wow. Our next guest, been around the track and field scene for a long time. He loves Australia and he loves Scotland. And that's because he won gold medals doing the high jump at the Commonwealth Games. And he medaled at the Pan Am Games and was an 8-time Canadian champ. He's been to a pair of Olympic Games. He's coached at the university level in Texas and at Kent State as well. And I think at New Mexico, if my memory is correct. And now he's helping out as an assistant coach right here in Toronto at York University. The name, Milton Audy. Many of you will remember his success representing this country in international competition. Milt, how you doing?
Not too bad, Aiden.
It's been a long time.
Oh, too long.
I get the feeling that when people start getting honored after the age of 50, that they figure you're either getting up there in years, and they better do it quickly before the inevitable happens to all of us. Do you get that feeling too?
Well, I'm old, but I don't think I'm that old.
No, you're not. I'm older than you. They're flying you to Calgary in June to be honored at the Athletics Canada, actually the Canadian Championships for track and field, but the Athletics Canada Hall of Fame. I would ask them why they wouldn't give you a free trip to Jamaica.
I don't know which one I prefer, actually.
You'd rather go to Calgary than Jamaica?
Well, for the honor.
Okay.
For the honor.
They're inducting
me, so I guess I have to go where the ceremony is.
Yeah, I would go there anyway, but I would ask for a special trip for you and your wife. I mean, this is a prestigious honor. Give you a little bit of vacation.
And that is badly needed, trust me.
10 people going into the Hall of Fame. Charmaine Crooks, who you know, we all know, Guillaume LeBlanc, Burnaby's Dave Steen, Bruni Surin, a little bit of speed on him still. Lyle Anderson will be inducted into the coaches category. Bob Adams enters the builders class. And we remember the success of three individuals and their contribution to track and field, Myrtle Cook, Fred Foote, and Harry Jerome as well. You got the call. I don't know if it was an email, it was a letter, somebody knocked on your door. Were you surprised?
A little bit. Actually, it was Rob Guy, the CEO, actually told me we're at a track meet at York University. And he comes up to me and he says, you know, congratulations. And I'm like, on what? And he's like, you're getting into Hall of Fame. And I'm like, really? He says, oh, you didn't know yet.
Oh, there we go. Surprise out of the hat.
So he says, okay, well, you know, you're getting in, so they're going to be contacting you.
Somebody forgot to call or the letter got stuck in the mail, went halfway around the world or something. What would you like people to remember about Milton Bruce Audy?
Oh, my God. Not the Bruce part. you know, it's me. I want them to remember me. I mean, it's wonderful to know that people, and I think people do remember me for what I want to be remembered for, and that's being a good person. Not just the fact that I was a great athlete or a good athlete, you know, fantastic high jumper, but when I meet people, like I do work in schools right now, you know, with my program, and what principals say to me is that I have goodwill. They remember what I did as a track athlete, but they remember that I was also inspirational to kids and personable. And I enjoyed that.
We look at your personal best performance. This goes back, sorry, I got to say this, I think about 19 years ago, and that was 2.33 meters. Doesn't sound like much, but we're talking about the high jump here. And you look at the current level of success by, I think it's, is it still by Javier Sotomayor?
The world record, yeah.
And what is it, 2.45?
4.5, I believe. 4.4 or 4.5. Yeah.
And that's been around for a long time.
Yep.
Do you think that's ever going to be beat?
Somewhere, somebody's going to beat it. But the problem that I find is that, as I think in a lot of sporting events right now, everybody's interested in winning. Everybody's interested in just doing it. But nobody's interested in just being the best. I recall this a lot of times. I talked to a lot of my old high jump friends. And we, back then, early 80s, if you will, we were interested in being the best in the world. So we did things to actually be better. It's not just about clearing the bar. Myself, I know technically nobody was better than I was. I had to be better, technically, because when I was shorter.
Milt Audie, how about making a comeback?
No, it hurts too much. It hurts too much. You know, when I retired, the first time I retired was when I took my posting at Kent State University, and I realized I can't train and train somebody else at the same time. And so I retired. I retired for about a year and then decided to come back. I missed it so much. And fortunately for me, it was not that far between when I retired and I actually tried to come back, and I ended up winning the Canadian Championships on the Olympic Trials. I didn't make the Olympic standard, but I won the Olympic Trials. Retired again, came back again, and then I retired again. And I think the hardest part for a world-class athlete is to actually let go.
The voice you hear is that of Milt Audie, one of 10 people being inducted into the Athletics Canada Hall of Fame next month in Calgary. Was I right before you coached Texas, Kent State, and also New Mexico?
New Mexico, exactly. New Mexico was my last posting.
All right. Now, you accepted, as a teen, a scholarship to go to university at Texas El Paso. When you look back now, any regrets about going to the U.S. rather than sticking it out here in Canada? Or did you think the experience, or did the experience help Milt Audie become as successful as you ended up being?
I think the experience was fantastic. I went to University of Texas, El Paso, which is in the middle of the desert. Nothing is there, realistically. You know, I remember landing on my recruiting trip. The plane landed, and I see no buildings. It was all like cactuses, desert, nothing. Is when the plane actually taxied into the airport, I actually saw the city. And I was scared because I had no idea where I was going. John, who was my track coach down there, I mean, was a fantastic recruiter, did a good job with me. I ended up going there because it was the best track and field school in America at the time.
High jumpers are usually tall or tend to be a certain height. In your case, and I say this with a lot of respect, you weren't tall. Does something like that have an effect on you as a high jumper?
Positively, for me, yeah, it was. Because, you know, when you're standing toe-to-toe with guys like Dietmar Morgenberg, who's 6 feet six,
yeah.
Patrick Sjoberg, you know, who's the same height, Jeff Parsons, who's 6 feet 7 feet, 6 feet 7 inches tall from Scotland, I had to have an advantage, and my advantage was that I used to stand beside them purposely so the people in the stands would see that I have a disadvantage. All right? So I don't know if people remember when I used to jump, I used to stand underneath the bar.
Yeah.
Because I really, when I started doing that, I wanted people to see the differences between what I was doing to what they were doing.
Different versions of going over the bar. I fair to assume that in your day, you did it one way. Nowadays, kids are being taught a different way. Which do you prefer?
Don't know if it's different. I just know that technically they're not as good. They're all going over the bar backwards now. Nobody does the, you know, there's no Western rolls, there's no straddle. Everybody's basically doing the flop. I just think that there's too many mistakes. The kids are stronger. They have a heck of a lot more talent than a lot of us did right now. But they really don't know how to high jump properly. They're just throwing themselves off the bar. So long as they clear the bar, that counts. But, you know, 20, 25 years ago, they're still jumping the same heights that we were jumping back then.
Do you think we're still getting a good group of high jumpers coming out of our... Are they coming out of our schools or are they coming out of the clubs?
They're coming out of the clubs. The schools right now the high schools, back in my day, back in the early 80s, late 70s, a lot of the track coaches were high school coaches. The high school coaches are now within the club system. From what I see, a lot of the high school coaches don't know that much about track, and they're scared of it.
Yeah, I said that too. They tell me I don't know what I'm talking about, but I see a significant decline in the kind of individual who is coaching at the high school level in many sports as well. Just one thing before we let you go, Milt. Is it true that at one time you were ranked the number one high jumper in the world?
Yeah, I'm very proud of that fact.
You
yeah.
should be. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure people heard that and they understood it as well. Congratulations to you.
Very much.
I mean, this is a long time coming, and you deserve it. You've represented this country with a lot of prestige, success as well, and you've definitely been a role model for a lot of younger individuals who have followed in your footsteps. You deserve it, Milt. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Milt Audy, Canadian high jumper, next month going to be inducted to the Athletics Canada Hall of Fame in Calgary prior to the national championships. And they should send him away, you know, an international trip for some major honor like that. We're going to take a break. Got a lot more coming your way. Stay with us. David Grossman, Sunday morning on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Sunday morning, May the 6th. This is Sportsnet 590, The Fan. David Grossman with you until the top of the hour. Just a reminder that a week today, I don't think you need any reminders, but Mother's Day is next Sunday. So it gives you some time to go out there and buy the flowers early if you have to, or the chocolates, even though the, you know, moms don't want chocolates. But you can get them whatever you have to clean up the room if you know what I mean. You know where I'm going. Anyway, mention York University and football, and the likelihood is people who know both might have a few chuckles. But head coach Warren Craney is making strides to turn this program around. I know Warren. I've got a lot of confidence, a couple of recruiting classes, and hopefully things will be a lot better. Our next guest was and still is the most successful football coach in the history of this sport at York University. He's also played in the Canadian Football League. He won a couple of great cups with the Tiger Cats. Then he became a professor, chairman of the physical education department, where he confronted issues and was very proactive about it. And I'm talking about a guy who is well-liked and well-respected, Frank Cosentino, who's going to be the recipient of a special award by the York Football Alumni Association at a gala event next Friday right here in downtown Toronto. And we have the honoree joining us right now. Frank, good morning, sir. It's been a while. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks, David. How about yourself?
Very well, thank you. You know, somewhat semi-retirement, but got to keep busy, as they say, right?
Yeah, right, sure.
You must have some really fond memories of those days at York, and particularly, I think it was 30-plus years ago, York's first winning season in football. You were the head coach. Do you remember all the hype?
Well, yes, I do in a lot of ways, and in a ways it was a little frightening because they hadn't won in 2 years. I was chairman of the phys ed program at the time, chairman, director of athletics and phys ed. And there was a lot of movement to cancel the program because they felt it was reflecting poorly on the university. And I certainly didn't want to do away with the football program on my watch, so I volunteered to coach in that, that would be 78, and to find out exactly what the problems were, why we couldn't win, and so on. So, and I never regretted it.
What were the problems?
Well, in a way, it was it had to do with the way York envisaged itself when it was instituted. The Tate McKenzie Building at York was designed to be an intramural building. The first phase that was going to be replaced by an intercollegiate type of facility building. There was no football stadium. There was just a huge field. In fact, we got a big kick out of it. The players ended up calling it Mile Wide Stadium because it was outdoors and in a field, no stands or anything like that. It was kind of nice, though, because game day, you'd find people wandering from the colleges and going around, ringing the field. And when we did win our first game, the word was getting around. And you could actually see the people starting to come and race over to the field to watch York win its first football game.
Some people will still say that York doesn't have a football field, maybe more of a, shall we say, a high school type of a field. The atmosphere is just not the same as you would find at, say, your alma mater at the University of Western Ontario. You look at the York program, the past few years hasn't been good. One of futility, I guess some would say. There was a victory over Waterloo this past season, 20-18. I think it was in overtime to break what was an almost four-year winless streak as the Cellar Dwellers. And the last six seasons, the numbers don't look good either. 3 wins, 45 losses. How do you, I mean, this is a headache, really, for a guy like Warren Craney. How do you take a program and rebuild it when it's so far down the ladder that it might affect some of these graduating high school kids with excellence in the sport from even coming to that university?
Yeah, you're right. But first of all, I do want to say that I think they're on the right way right now. I think Warren Craney and Michael Falds and the coaching staff that he's got, I think they're busy doing some recruiting, and I think that's the key. You have to do some recruiting to get credibility. I remember, again, in 1978, where I had minimal time to do recruiting, and so I went to Northern Collegiate, and Clark Pulford, who I played with at Western, was a football coach there, and he just told me up front, he says, Frank, look, I'm not going to be able to recommend anybody to York until you fix up that program, until it's a place where students can go and learn and if necessary, be prepared to go on to the future. And I think Warren's got the same task. And I'm quite sure that he's capable and he's going to rise to that occasion. And all that, I think, will be not forgotten, but be built upon. And the team will be successful, I think, within the next 1 year, 2 years.
Frank Cosentino joining us, our guest on Sunday morning on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, retired with the most successful record in football coaching at York University, 25 wins, 25 losses. I talked to a couple of players at York, Frank, and they tell me it was the low morale, that you got to build confidence in the team, in the players. And when others hear that, they tend to fuel on it as well, that one win at a time turns a program around. Are you in favor of having a two-tier system, or does that just create a league that could be referred to as a league of shambles? I'm looking at having a league with, say, Western and Queens and some of the top teams, McMaster on one side, and giving the second division an opportunity to develop the teams like U of T, York, Waterloo, some of the others. What are your thoughts behind something like that?
Well, yeah, there are some pluses to it, and I think you've pointed them out. On the other hand, though, while there are more universities playing football now than ever were when I was coaching, I don't know if there are enough, and the travel would be almost too much if you went to an elite category of four schools. And they've been talking about doing that for years, Western and Queens and McGill and, you know, the former Big Four and everything
right.
Like that. I think the right approach is just to be able to develop a program, to recruit, to bring people in, to have them experience defeat and learn from their mistakes and in effect really be a good coach and a good teacher and try to build up morale by, you know, a little bit at a time and eventually the chips will fall into place, and I think it'll turn out well.
I'm glad, Frank, that York is recognizing you, the Football Alumni Association, for your success and everything you've done to contribute to football players and, for that matter, athletes in general having an opportunity to excel under your leadership. Congratulations on the special award this coming Friday. And let's talk once the football season starts rolling and see how successful Michael and Warren and everybody is in turning the program around. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Dave.
Frank Cosentino, just an outstanding individual being honored this Friday. Well, Canada has a chance to make the Olympics in women's basketball. For the first time in a dozen years, the Olympic qualifying tournament's in Turkey. The Canucks need to finish in the top five of what is going to be a very tough 12-country tournament. And we have a three-game exhibition tourney in BC coming up against the Chinese later on this month. And joining us right now, a member of our Canadian roster, Chelsea Obrey, is with us, a graduate University of Nebraska, multi-award winner. Her hometown is Kitchener, and she's hoping to stir things up for the Canadians. Chelsea, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. Thanks very much for getting up a bit early. I understand you're on the West Coast in BC, and, well, a couple of hours can, on a Sunday morning, you could use a sleep. Your veteran experience is what Canada is looking for. I keep hearing it over and over again. We need more Chelseas on this roster. You have it. Are you expected to lead by example? I mean, are you making sure, are you the one that's supposed to step up and tell everybody we can do it?
I think so. There's a couple of us on the team that have been around for a while, and, you know, that's what they're looking from us, not only, you know, to play well on the court, but off the court to kind of guide and mentor, you know, the young ones that are in training camp right now. And, you know, once we get to Turkey, because we've been in these kinds of situations. Unfortunately, sometimes they haven't fallen in our way, but we've been in these situations, and I think that we're the ones to look to.
In the game of basketball, you need, at least I'm told, you need height, you need speed, you need talent, and you also need a great defense. Some say this could be the best group of Canadian women in a long time. Would you agree from what you've seen that it's going to be tough to condense this roster to come up with the best because there's just so many of you?
It's true. You know, looking at camp, we're bigger. You know, it's hard to say. Canada's never said we're a big team, and we're big. There's lots of big girls. We're quick. We're smart. Defensively, we're probably one of the best in the world. And I think it will be hard for the coaches to pick a team because there are so many good players. The other thing that makes us good is there is a core group of us, like I said before, of 6-7 players that have been around for a little bit, and we experienced not qualifying for the last Olympics. And so I think, you know, you take that kind of, you know, emotion with it, and hopefully we can do it this year.
How difficult, though, is it to get a group of talented athletes, they all know they're good at what they do, to adjust to a coach's philosophy in a short span of time, knowing that it's not individuals anymore, we got to work as a team, we're representing this country?
I think it's a hard thing. It's very hard, especially when a lot of our players go down to the States. And, you know, they're all kind of starters on their team, and then they come to the national team, and it's like, whoa, it's kind of like a step, not a step back for them, but, you know, we're all great up here. And so I think it's a hard thing for the coaches to get us all to buy in and on the same page. But I think the other neat thing about coming to the national team is everyone wants to be here and everyone wants to represent their country, that you're willing to do whatever. Even if you're like the 12th person on the bench, that person is working just as hard as, you know, the starting five. And so it's kind of also a neat thing.
Chelsea Obrey is with us. She's from Kitchener, 6'2" forward. You played in Australia, right?
Yep.
Great experience down there?
Oh, it's a great league to play in. I've been there for 3 years, and I look to go back maybe for a fourth. And so it's been a great experience.
What's your perception being in this national team camp now with players who you see the light at the end of the tunnel, and that is the Olympics. But you, in order to get there, you got to get through this qualifying round first. Is it difficult making that adjustment, focusing on what has to be done in Turkey?
I don't think it's difficult. I think it's kind of, for some of us who have been here for so long and, like I said, haven't succeeded making the Olympics, I think it's just really exciting because we're like, we're so close and we're so good and we think that we can do it with this team, that it's almost refreshing when in other years we're like, it is just an uphill battle trying to get there. But I think this year we have the personnel, we have the systems, we have the coaching staff, and we have that, I think, belief that it almost makes it even better.
You have a three-game series with the Chinese Olympic team. Do you worry about, are you concerned about beating them or about making sure that everyone does what is asked of them to be done so that you're focusing on what lies ahead after the Chinese experience?
Yeah, when we play exhibition games like playing against the Chinese, we don't go in saying we need to win this game. And if we come out with three losses, we come out with three losses. Of course, for team morale, you want to win. But you kind of go in, and I think for the coaches, they're looking for, okay, what groups play together and what defense works against taller players, what doesn't work, what we're just kind of looking for things that work and don't work, and then from there you can clean it up.
Canada's last Olympic appearance in women's basketball came in the 2000 games in Sydney. We finished, I think it was fifth in our group with a 2-3 record. and settled for 10th overall. Now we're ranked 11th, and we're in a pool with France and with Mali. The idea here is you got to win that pool to move on?
Yeah. So I think you have to come top two, and then you cross over. But we're very happy with the pool that we were given and also the size of the draw that we were given. And we're very confident. You know, you don't get overconfident, but we're very confident in what we've been given. And we, you know, amongst our team and stuff, we have that feeling of, yeah, if we play well and we do the things that we're capable of doing, then we will be seeing London, hopefully.
The players in this Canadian camp, are they just going in there knowing, okay, we'll take this one step at a time, or are they all fired up as if this is the last game of the Stanley Cup?
You try not to get all fired up, but like inside you're always like that because you do. Like you said, you see the light at the end of the tunnel, but you know, you kind of have to take a step back from that, and you do have to take one day at a time and, you know, go through the process. But, you know, we do feel that way. We're like, oh, it's here, finally. We've been waiting for 4 years, and so, you know, we are quite fired up about it.
Well, go for it, Chelsea. We appreciate you taking time. Congratulations on your basketball success, and let's hope you're on that team, and the Canadians do extremely well when it comes to Olympic time.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Thanks again. Chelsea Obrey, a great basketball player, hoping for a spot on the Canadian roster as we challenge for an opportunity to play the Olympic Games. We're done. You hear the music. Thanks to all our guests. Been a busy show, 12 of them. You can check us out if you want on podcast at www.fan590.com. If you missed a segment, you want to refer one to friends and relatives. Producer of Sunday Morning is Igor Enriquez. Technical director today, Brett Armstrong. Gentlemen, great job. We thank you very much. David Grossman is my name. This has been Sunday Morning. Have yourself a great day. We'll see you in seven more on Sportsnet 590, The Fan.